Today is December 2nd. It's Friday morning at Sheret Israel, and we are learning Masechet Baba Kama, chapter 1. We're beginning Mishnah 2 today. So let's see, does everyone have the sources in the Mishnah?
No.
Sources in the Mishnah, so I'll give this to you, the handout. And if you have one at home, then give this back at the end of the day. If you don't have one at home and you're planning to come back, then you can keep it. Right, so this goes back over there. And Rina, do you want one for today?
Yes.
I see I only have the original. So please remember to return it. And then for the source, the question sheets today, I gave it out last week. We didn't get to it.
But you weren't here. Rina, me.
And I do have more copies.
I wasn't here either.
So here's another copy. So here's one.
This is Baba Kama Mishnah 1.
Mishnah 2.
Mishnah 2.
Again, I gave it out last week, but if you don't have... No, one of our question sheets, that's what I said.
I've got a question
sheet. Right? So it says on the top, chapter 1, Mishnah 2.
Oh, no.
There's a few of
them. I don't have one.
Okay.
Yeah. No, last week.
Anyone else need? So it's tractate Baba Kama, chapter 1, Mishnah 2. Is anyone else, everyone okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we're going to begin
page
reading 20. The Mishnah. The Mishnah, chapter 1, Mishnah 2 of Masechet Baba Kama begins as follows. Here we go. Kol shechavti vishmirato, hikshati et nizko. Hikshati vimtsat nizko, havti v'tashlumin bekekshir. Kol nizko. Let's translate that. Back to the beginning. Kol shehavti vishmirato. So we really should recognize, at least recognize, if not understand, all three words. The first word, kol, we know that means all or everything or everyone. Shehavti, of course, is two words. She, which we know means that or because. And then havti. Well, we can see that there is a suffix at the end of taf yud, which of course is the first person past tense, singular, I. And then we wonder the verb chet bet, what it means. So I'll just tell everyone that you're used to seeing this verb with two yuds in the middle. You're used to seeing chayav, chet yud yud bet, chayav. And I hope that at least some people remember what chayav means.
You have to.
Right, you have to. Obligated. And here it's in the past tense, first person singular. So it means that you have to, that you're obligated.
Which word
that
is
I
this?
Are we,
that I had to, right.
Could you give me the word again?
Chetbet. Chetbet.
Oh.
So then we get to the third word, bishmirato. And you understand at the beginning there is a prefix, a bet, which means in or with or concerning. And the end is to, mean it's the feminine it, possessive. Bish. So the word shmira, the basic root there, is of course, what is shmira?
Guarding,
right? So bishmirato in its guarding. Put it all together, kol shechavti bishmirato, all that I was obligated in its guarding, right? In every case in which I was obligated in guarding it, hiksharti et nizko. Hiksharti from the language of kosher. But it's a hifil, meaning that it is causative. So all that I made kosher, it's nezek. We know that nezek means damage, right? So, to put it all together, all that I was obligated in its guarding, I made kosher its nezek. What does made kosher mean? It means to facilitate, to make it good, to make it happen. So what I'm being told here is that in any case in which I was obligated to guard, and then added the missing words, and I didn't, then it's considered as if I facilitated the nezek, even though I didn't do it. But if I did something, I should rather say if I didn't do something that I was supposed to do to prevent the nezek, that's the guarding, and it happened, it's my responsibility. And that's, of course, what we call in English negligence. So the principle is here that the negligent is considered to be the cause. and has to pay as if he did it. Let's go on. Hikshati vingtzat nizko, chavti betashlumin kehekshar kol nizko.
You have the original.
Oh. Bit your thumb?
No, she's all right.
I forgot.
I just told her not to mark on the original.
Okay. So, hikshati vimiktsat nizko. We know already there the word hikshati, and we know already the last word nezik, nizko, his nezik. So what about the word vimiktsat? And there you... It's so hard for Ilana. She's trying to hold herself back and not tell us all the answers. So the word vimiktsat has in it the word ktsat. The last three letters, kuf tzadi taf, tzat. Right.
Well, ketz means end.
Right. Tzat doesn't mean end.
No, so it means part.
Very good. Ah, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Right, very good. Ktsat, right, is a little bit. Vimiktsat is in a little bit. So what it's saying is, hikshati vimiktsat nizko, if I facilitated part of the nezik, chavti betashlumin, I'm obligated in payment kehekshar, as if facilitation of all nezik. So even if I am a facilitator, part of the nezik merely, I have to pay for it. It's as if I created all the nezik. And we'll have to now look in the Torah. So let's get the books off the shelf. We'll have to find in the Torah where actually the source of this idea is. So again, the basic idea is very clear. And what it means is that if you're negligent when you have an obligation to guard, and nezik occurs through your negligence, you are obligated as if you yourself created the nezik. And then secondly, we're saying, even if you're only partly responsible for creating the nezik, you have to pay for all of it. So the place we should look to find the sources of these two points is in the Torah. And of course, we're in Shmot, the end of chapter 21 and the beginning of chapter 22. So the first question is, where do we find this principle that obligation to pay is a function of not fulfilling your obligation to guard? Where do we find that? So look at the end of Shmot, chapter 21. You have to open it up. Open it up. Look for the answer.
Where is Shmot?
Shmot is Exodus.
Okay, so that's on page... That's on page 464.
Right. Ilana, just tell us the answer before you found the place.
464.
464. And Ilana tells us it's which verse?
Well, I didn't hear.
Verse 36.
Verse 36. At the end of chapter 21, page 464. What it says there is follows... 35 and 36. When a man's ox injures his neighbor's ox and it dies, this is when my possession damaged your possession. They shall sell the live ox and divide its price. They shall all divide the dead animal. In other words, I'm paying half nezik. If, however, it is known that the ox was in the habit of goring and its owner has failed to guard it, it must restore ox for ox. You have to pay full nezik. Why? It says because its owner failed to guard it. There you have the principle of obligation in Shmirah.
I'm confused about partially responsible.
I didn't get to that yet.
Okay.
So then Bob says, let's get ready to the second matter. Mm-hmm. A partial responsibility creating full obligation to pay. So that is actually found in the scenario of the pit. In verse 33 and 34. Let's read it carefully as we did about a month ago. Let's read it again. When a man opens a pit or digs a pit. I'll stop right there. It looks a little bit strange. If a man opens a pit or digs a pit. What do you mean, open or dig? Just say if a man dug a pit.
Where?
No, what does it mean, open a pit? What does that mean? 33. If you uncovered a pit that someone else dug.
You're moving too fast.
Verse 33.
Of what? Of which chapter?
21.
Page 464.
Okay, when a man opens a pit.
So a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it.
Mm-hmm.
Which implies that if you dig a pit but you do cover it, You're not covered in this category. An ox and ass falls into it. The one responsible for the pit must make restoration and pay the price to the owner.
Okay.
So what do we have here? We seem to have the following. Two separate scenarios. I did not dig a pit. I just uncovered the pit that you dug. And I still have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I didn't dig the pit. I'm only responsible for a portion of the act that created the nezek. I didn't dig it, I only uncovered it, but still I have to pay. And secondly, if I dug a pit and did not cover it, it says I'm responsible. Implying if I dug it and covered it, I'm not responsible. Which means if I dug it and covered it, and you came and uncovered it, you're responsible and I'm not. So the principle seems to be that, number one, someone who facilitates only part of the nezek is responsible for all the nezek, but that doesn't mean that two people are responsible only for one nezek, it's the second one. It's the one who does the final act. Again, if I dug the pit but covered it, and someone else fell in because a third party uncovered it, I'm not responsible. The uncoverer is responsible. So it looks like, again, the principle that he who facilitated part of the nezek is obligated for all of it is true. It comes from the Torah. But it doesn't mean that two people are responsible for one nezek. It means that the final one is responsible, one who uncovers the pit.
How do you get to that? Because... So the assumption then is when it states ki yiftach, if open, that becomes a first statement, or digs. So if I walk along and I see something interesting, see a bunch of boards or something, and I open it up for whatever reason, then I become the person responsible for that pit.
Yes.
Yeah. Not the digger.
Right. The digger? Because the digger fulfilled his obligation to what?
Cover it.
To cover it. And in the language of the Mishnah, how would we call covering it? We only saw like 8 words, so it's not so hard a question. The response, covering it, is fulfilling the obligation of?
Shmirah.
Of guarding.
Well,
right? But just 1 second, right? There's guarding of a goring ox.
Yeah.
There's guarding of a pit. How do you guard a goring ox? You put it in a corral. How do you guard a pit? You cover it.
All right. I disagree with your interpretation because you are only taking a small group of words, not reading it in its entirety. In the law, it says any damage done by man is his total responsibility for the ultimate outcome. So if I dig a pit and then cover it with a cloth and don't put signs around it, and even if I do put signs around it, I have to be cognizant. I know that there are some nars, there are some idiots who will say, oh, that's okay. I have to literally stand there 24 hours a day and prevent you and Charlie from walking along studying Talmud and not paying attention to where you're going.
Is this a New Deal approach to damages?
Yeah. But haven't you heard that comment that you live for the Torah, you don't stand in front of the pit for the Torah?
So in legal terms, in halachic terms,
you're just right, waiting for me to
what Bruce is bringing up is the following question. We have to define what is
Shmirah.
What is a reasonable level of Shmirah? And obviously there could be a debate.
But that's the average, we talk about the average reasonable man or woman.
Yeah, but
so obviously covering with a cloth is not shmirah, but covering with boards that would usually stay there under normal wind conditions, let's say, Probably would be Shmirah.
No, but you have to nail the boards together. You have
very
to
good.
You,
that you has to be discussed.
You have to do a. You have to. You have to protect.
Fine.
The world
good.
From the
good.
Stupid
like we
and the innocent.
Believe it or not, we discussed this actually 2 weeks ago.
All right.
Remember, we brought up about covering a swimming pool in your own backyard.
Right.
Bruce is not setting up a reasonable man standard. He's setting up an unreasonable man standard.
But I think that you're probably right. But be that as it may, our Mishnah is setting up principles. It's not yet discussing the details of what constitutes Shmirah. That'll come in much, much later chapters. We just have now the principle that, number one, lack of Shmirah creates obligation to pay. Secondly, even if you created part, if you're part of the reason for the cause of Nezik, you have to pay for all of it. And who has to pay? The final creator of the Nezik. We'll see later on, not today, but another few years, that it's not just a matter of one person digs a pit and covers it, another uncovers it, so the second is responsible. What about if I dig a pit that is only half a foot deep and wouldn't hurt anyone that fell in it, but you come and take my pit and deepen it? Right. That's another example of the same type of thing. And then the Gemara discusses, well, what depth of pit is considered to be non-dangerous, and what depth of pit is considered to be dangerous, and dangerous for who? For people, for animals. What type of animals?
For old people.
Hopefully the pit to be dug for the wicked will be deep.
Very deep. Okay, so with that, we're going to go on in reading the rest of the Mishnah. Here we go. Picking up where we left off. Nechasim she'ein behem mi'ila. And why don't I explain what that means?
It's line two. You ended on line two.
And that's where I'm picking up. I don't have the same print as you have.
No.
Mila, yeah.
Nechasim means possessions. She'ein behem mi'ila. Mi'ila is often translated as embezzlement from the temple. But the English translation really doesn't help. What does your English translation
sacrilege.
Say? That's good also. What it means is as follows.
Love sacrilege.
Yes. Things that belong to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. If you damage them, if you steal them, if they use them when you're not allowed, you're not only stealing, but you're also committing mi'ila, embezzlement, sacrilege. And the Torah mandates payments beyond and above what you would pay if you misused my object, or if you stole my object. So, nechasim that have mi'ila, it means nechasim that belong to the temple, and if you misappropriate them, you are guilty of mi'ila, guilty of sacrilege. Whereas nechasim that don't have mi'ila, it means nechasim that are owned by most of the world, and if you steal them or damage them, you're only guilty of an avirah, bin adam l'chaviro, something between man and man, but it's not mi'ila, it's not between man and God. So when this says nechasim she'ein behem mi'ila, and the sentence will go on to say, that's when all these laws apply. The laws we're learning apply only bein adam l'chaviro, between man and man. But if your ox gores the temple, right? It's a whole different can of kosher worms. These laws don't apply. Much more serious laws apply. So that's what it's saying, that all the laws apply only to nechasim she'ein behem mi'ila.
So mi'ila is only with the temple? Or
yes, only
also,
the
temple. Let's say today in a synagogue or something? No.
No. Nechasim shel v'nei brit. Nechasim that belong to b'nei brit.
Jews?
Not to B'nai Brit in Washington.
Not Hadassah, but to B'nai
Brit. Right, not Rat Hadassah, but B'nai Brit.
To the Jewish people. To the Jewish people.
It's Jews.
Yeah.
Right. These laws only apply
to the circumcised.
To the circumcised.
Also women.
Including women. It's not a recommendation for female circumcision. So this is a law. We're saying these laws of paying damages when your ox or your pit or your fire damages someone else or someone else's possessions, they apply only when the other person's possessions are possessions of B'nai B'rit, of Jews. Now, that might cause many people in this room to become up in arms. Because what it's saying is something that on the surface doesn't seem to be very discriminatory. That if my ox gores Ilana's ox, I have to pay. But if it damages, gores the ox of someone who's not Jewish, I don't have to pay. And the truth is that this law was absolutely used in many Jewish-Christian polemics in the Middle Ages as an objection, I should say more than objection, as a serious objection to Judaism and criticizing it as being self-centered and discriminatory against Christians and others. Mm-hmm. And it is discriminatory.
Yes.
We cannot deny that. What we can do is try and figure out why.
So if you went to Moab and dug a pit, you didn't have to cover it.
That's what it looks like. At least, perhaps you have to cover it, but you don't have to pay if you didn't.
No, I think maybe for the non-Jews, it's done in Archaot Shel Goyim, in courts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a principle of reciprocity. Did I say it right?
Reciprocity.
Oh, so they're saying if you're dealing with somebody who's not Jewish, there'll be another way to settle this.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. That's what it looks like. It, okay. Although you put it a bit more innocuously than certain historians would put it, it basically says, look, if a non-Jew, and of course we're in the Roman period here, right? If a non-Jew, a Roman citizen, damaged the possessions of a Jewish non-Roman citizen, the Roman courts are not going to exact from the Roman citizen damage money for what he did to the Jew who's not a citizen of Rome. So if their courts are not going to look out for Jewish interests, then our courts are not going to look out for non-Jewish interests. It's, how do I say it again?
Reciprocity.
Because were Jewish courts to demand of Jews to pay damage money when they damage the possessions of non-Jewish Roman citizens, then we would be discriminated against our own people.
Mm-hmm.
It would create an imbalance. Well, that is the way many historians explain the law that we have here.
Well, we know historically with the French emancipation, when they finally decided to give Jews citizenship, one of the conditions that was set forth, they had several. One of the conditions was that Jews had to no longer have their courts.
Really?
Jews had their own courts in Alsace-Lorraine, and that was one of the complaints. And there are a number of other things. One of the things that the anti-Semites complained about was that the Jews dressed differently, and they wanted to change that. But Jews had their courts right through the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, governments let them have their courts
in Dallas,
except in capital cases.
Their courts today. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Western Europe.
Ah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because as far as the East is concerned, you know, that's a whole different world.
So also that principle of not charging interest to your fellow Jew, but you can do it to other people. So that's also kind of irritates people on the other side.
Yeah. I'm sure it does. Let's not open up the whole can right now.
This is different than strangers too. Okay.
If Jews go to countries that are predominantly not Jewish, they're still expected to follow, among Jews, to follow all the Jewish rules.
Yes, they are.
I have a hard time seeing how. I understand the concept of you know, if they're not going to treat us well, we're not going to treat them well. It seems to be inherently anti-Jewish.
No,
in your own country, you don't make the strangers or the servants work on Shabbat. you know, that other people are given consideration. This doesn't seem to, seems to stand alone with everything that I understand to be a Jewish value, that, you know, that...
Jewish values sometimes must be compromised in the face of a harsh reality. And if you're in a reality in which legal systems defend only citizens of that system, then if you don't work within that harsh reality, you end up shooting yourself in the foot.
But you would have to admit this system obviously creates a conflict with any temporal system, legal system that may exist on the planet. In other words, there's our system, and then there's a system for, I suppose, everyone else.
Well, no,
and it separates then the Jews from... Again,
No. What it is multiple systems existing at the same time, each for its own citizens.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not saying that's an ideal situation.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the Jewish people had to work within the reality that they found themselves in.
Yeah.
That's all. I don't like it.
No. So this would be something that perhaps... today, the people who came to this conclusion maybe would come to a different conclusion.
Yeah. Take a look at the context. When I talked about Jewish courts, if it was an act against a non-Jew, then the Jewish courts couldn't do their thing.
And the non-Jewish courts would do their thing.
Non-Jewish. If you go to the Chabad community today in New York, they have a system of courts for civil matters between their adherents.
Yeah.
And one of the complaints about Chabad is that they don't take serious things like spousal abuse or anything like that to the regular... In fact, they avoid the regular court system for things like that.
It's like Penn State.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
But we don't say that, you know, you can covet your neighbor's wife if the neighbor's not Jewish.
No, that's a universal law.
Yeah, but isn't this, if we put this in proper context, this was written at the time that this was written.
Yeah,
people thought six blocks away was the end of the world. The
right.
world ended six blocks away, so all they were concerned about were making laws for the 6-block radius that their shtetl. Occupied. They didn't know nothing from the people on the other side of the river.
Well, this
that's not
I'm not sure that
the river
came
a trouble to Rome.
No. This was written when the Romans were in control.
Okay.
And they'd already gone through a Greek occupation, by the way.
Right.
There was already a diaspora by this time.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
What's the difference between this and the Islamic
Sharia.
When you say this, what do you mean by this?
In other words, it's a whole system of, I guess, for
legal
lack of a better
system.
Legal system based upon religious beliefs, period. And it often conflicts with any temporal system of law.
We have a definite declaration that the law of the land is the law.
So, in ideal sense, the Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebal Peh are meant to be, so it appears, a comprehensive legal system that covers all matters of human behavior, whether it's ben adam l'chaviro or ben adam l'makom. There is no distinction. The Torah covers it all, and Torah Shebal Peh covers it all. Then what happens when this legal system that's meant to be all-encompassing and cover the life of a Jew from birth to death, what happens when that legal system finds itself in a world, in a reality, in which there are other legal systems that control the political life of the people? So then Jews have to a certain degree, limit their legal system, and they have to come up with rules of a modus vivendi to live in two worlds at once. And that's what Ilana said, Dina de Malchuta Dina, which is a principle that covers which of our laws should we remain faithful to when we're in a larger society of its own laws, and which laws concerning which do we give up our autonomy to the larger legal framework. And it's not an easy matter to maneuver and navigate that balance.
But just to answer his question, I mean, there are some places where Sharia law it goes over and above the law of the land, but I think there are places where Sharia law does, you know, within that community.
Is the law of that land.
Does rule, just as we have a Bet Din that makes rulings on certain things for us Jewish people. Not that we can, you know, go by that, the Bet Din, and violate some law United States.
Yeah. The question, there's a struggle going on within Israel on this very matter.
Yeah, of course there is. Let's not get into bigger things.
But there is a difference. If you say, well, if I want to make this the law of the land, that becomes a totally different matter than if I just want to apply it within my community.
Right. Look, even your family has laws.
Yeah, but again, we're getting... let's keep this relevant to us and to the Mishnah. So let me point out the following. I think this is very relevant. In in America, whether you're Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, even if you're Orthodox, you're really not living within the original envisioned Torah law. Mm-hmm. Even the Orthodox really take into account only 5% of the Torah. Look what we're learning today. We're learning Baba Kama, right? This is part of Jewish law just as much as Sukkah is, or as much as Brachot are, or as much as Shabbat is. According to what's envisioned by Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, when you think about what you're doing on Saturday, you consult Jewish law. But also, when you think about going into business or digging a pit, you also consult Jewish law, both as far as how you should behave lahatchila to begin with, and how you should behave if you cause some damage. But of course, by and large, we don't do that now. And part, this is, you could say, a implication and ramification of Napoleon. That since the emancipation, and the Jewish people have, I'll say it like this, been forced out of the ghetto and forced into a larger world, we've basically been forced to abandon much of Judaism. And I'm not talking about Shabbat and Kashrut, I'm talking about abandoned Baba Kama, which is just as much a part to begin with as anything else. So let me give an example of this, which I just read an article about a few weeks ago. Everyone knows that in America there's such a thing as bankruptcy. Right now American Airlines is going into bankruptcy. And of course there are bankruptcy laws, not just for companies, for individuals. Now I don't know anything about bankruptcy laws. I just know one principle, which is that some of your debts are renegotiated. So now let's say the following case. I owe Charlie $100 because I took a loan from him.
It's a good day.
And now I go into bankruptcy. I file for a personal bankruptcy in court.
That's a bad day.
And the court either decides I don't have to pay him, or I only have to pay 50%. Am I allowed not to pay him? Because in Jewish law there's no bankruptcy. And Jewish law says if I take a loan I have to pay it. So what's this thing that a Jew goes to bankruptcy court in Texas, gets his loans absolved, but the Torah still says you have to pay?
Until a certain year comes.
But that doesn't apply today. The laws of the Jubilee year don't apply today.
They don't apply?
No, but let's not get into that. So I'm just trying to point out that there could really be conflicts between Jewish law and secular that we just ignore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's different to say that under the law of the United States, you're only required to pay Charlie $50, but you feel compelled by other...
Not feel compelled. Jewish law says I have to pay him back his loan.
Can you take are compelled, to
but you're compelled by Jewish law to pay him the other 50. That's different from saying that, well, that the Would you feel that, but you wouldn't have that compulsion if you had also borrowed $100 from somebody who wasn't Jewish and didn't, and were told the court said pay him 50?
Good question. Okay. I don't know the answer to that.
So can Charlie take you to Beit Din?
It could be very well. This was something article I read. Perhaps he could take me to Beit Din to demand the other $50.
Yes.
I want to ask the same question on Mo's example, though, with the spousal abuse. If Elena's beaten up.
God forbid.
Or is beating up somebody else.
All right. She's the abused in this case. Would she be required in a place like New York to go to the Chabad court as opposed to the secular court? Or is it a question of where she resides that controls? In other words, or is it the culture that she's in that controls?
There is a law that's called Arkaot Hagoyim.
Mm-hmm.
Which means the courts of the non-Jews. And in general, there's a law that says that if there is a issue that comes up that's covered by Jewish law, and there is a local Jewish Beit Din, that you're forbidden from going to non-Jewish court until you've gone through the process of a Jewish court.
Really?
Now, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And there, that is a law on the books of Torah Shebal Peh. There are many, 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 many exceptions, and I don't know anything about the Myrad exceptions. Of course, according to the law of Arkaot Goyim, a Jewish boy or girl could not and should not go to American law school, and certainly should not function as a lawyer.
Really?
Because he is facilitating people to the use of non-Jewish courts. But then you ask me, how could Yeshiva University have a law school? Right? Ask me that question, right?
All of us.
You understand the question?
Yeah.
How could there be a Cardozo Law School at Yeshiva University? The answer is there's lots of exceptions to the basic law that you can't have recourse to non-Jewish courts.
Most center.
But at least you should be aware in principle of the concept of Arkaot HaGoyim.
So technically, if it's a Jew and a Jew that have this dispute or this problem,
they start with the Jewish court.
You have to go to the if you're
in principle,
you have to go to that court first.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In principle.
How does Judaism change and go forward? What do we use for Judaism to give Judaism that flexibility? You know, like Shabbat stays.
Wait a second, that's like another question completely. That's another subject. Let's stay where we are.
This is an example of moving forward.
I just want to do
it. Right? I mean, it didn't exist before. Suddenly the conditions were changed. So now we get this.
And there are commentaries upon commentaries on this Mishnah that cover changing circumstances.
The way regular law evolves, the same way.
So we do accept that Judaism does evolve.
Absolutely.
And what we are discussing right now is a time in Israel where the Romans,
where
we were living in our land, but we had no control over the judicial system because the Romans took over. First the Greeks took over, and then the Romans. But this is in Israel as citizens
No, that's very good. And then there are later commentaries to that deal with the question, what would we do when you have a Jewish law system in a Jewish country that has to also negotiate its relationships with non-Jewish citizens? There are those commentaries that say, what about this exception that the laws only apply if you damage a Jew's stuff? How does that apply in a Jewish state? These things are absolutely discussed in halachic literature. Carolyn wanted to say something.
I just want to say that my father-in-law, Shalom, would not take a Jewish person to court, to a civil court,
mm-hmm.
only to a Beit Din.
This might be the reason.
Was a lawyer, right?
He was a lawyer, in modern times, he was just gone.
This is the first time I heard about it.
Wow.
And it's good Charlie heard it, but that's only after he retired.
No, that's that. Right. That would ruin my practice. But you can't, you're saying this was then and it's evolved. Okay, I got that. But it's still part of the Torah. And if you accept the Torah, then you have to accept this, right?
By this, you mean the prohibition that I mentioned?
This is the word. This is the interpretation. If you're a Jew, you're bound as much by this as you are by any other section of the section of the.
You know, again, there's lots. We're only seeing a tiny bit on every word here. Mm-hmm. There's interpretation and there's application to changing circumstances. But in principle, we've said some things that are true.
Even today. We've been fortunate to represent the Vietnamese community in on the Gulf Coast, and when there's a dispute between older Vietnamese who are both Catholic, they first insist upon going to see Father Vinh. I mean, whoever is the priest at Mary Queen of Vietnam, they'll go and see him. They can't get it resolved. Then they go to the lawyer.
A young girl in my bank, she's evangelical. She goes to her church for any disputes between, and they do that first.
Okay.
And a lot of religious communities do that.
Look, people go to mediation before they go to court.
Well, there was a time when there was a dispute, you went to the saloon keeper.
Okay, let's go on with the Mishnah. Okay, so we're talking about the cases in which these laws apply. They apply when possessions are damaged which don't belong to the temple. Mm-hmm. They apply only when that which is damaged belongs to B'nai B'rit. And then it says they apply only to Nechasim Miyuchadim, which means designated.
What is it?
Possessions. That only possessions that belong to someone are you liable to pay for damages. But if you damage something that doesn't have an owner, you don't have to pay? For example, a stray dog. If I inadvertently run over a stray dog, I don't have to pay because no one owns it. That's probably today one of the few applications. Today, almost everything is owned, right? Mm-hmm. Every single tree and any forest on wherever, everything is owned. In ancient times, it wasn't. There were many things that were hefker. They weren't owned by anyone.
Mm-hmm. Because they're owned by the government, right?
Whatever it is, the government or a private individual or an investor. But it has to be nechasim miyuchadim that are designated for a certain owner. Not necessarily a private owner, but an owner. And then it says, uvechol makom. Everywhere. These laws apply everywhere.
So if you damage, let's say, the quality of the air is kind of not owned.
That's pollution now. But that's today. I wonder what pollution was then, besides.
Well, I'm trying to apply it today, too.
You're not damaging the air, you're damaging the lungs of individual persons.
Okay.
And the halakha certainly talks about that.
Right. If you have operated a tannery next to somebody's home, their home would smell very badly.
And the law actually discusses that. Mm-hmm. Mm. The law talks about...
We have a lot of borsikain then.
Right, let's go on.
Where are we?
We're in the...
Please.
Word chutz.
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 Except.
Except. Right, we said that these laws apply in this case, chutz. Now exception. There's an exception when the laws don't apply. You ready for this?
Yes.
Chutz merishut hamiyuhedit lamazik. Except for a domain that is designated for the mazik. Remember what the mazik is? The mazik is the damager. So in other words, if I damage you on my property, I don't have to pay.
Oh, really?
So let's not jump to conclusions. But the simplest case is the following. That you trespass on my property and you fall in my pit.
Or my dog bit you.
Or the dog bit you. So you come and demand damage. I say, what are you doing on my property? And then that gets to the question we discussed 2 weeks ago, do I have to cover up a pit that's in my property? Right? Let's say the property was fenced in, but the pit wasn't covered. So I could claim, what are you doing on my property? So here it seems, again, we're not going into the details, but as a general principle, the laws that say that negligence and not preventing nezik is a reason that you have to pay, it doesn't apply on my own property. I can have dangerous dogs and open pits on my own property, because you shouldn't be on my property.
This is the opposite of what Bruce said before.
Very near the opposite of what Bruce said, right.
Yeah. Does that have anything to do with if your property is not marked private property?
Very good question. The truth is, we are not getting to that. We're seeing a principle. Okay, it later has to be fleshed out.
Okay. You're laying out a sole set of
principles,
mm-hmm. and then we will see how they apply.
Right, and details.
Yeah, like where there is no boundary, and you go and take an axe and chop a tree, and you find out that it's your neighbor's tree,
and you didn't right. know. Okay, all that has to be discussed. Now, about to say something? No.
I after reading these two Mishnahs, I've decided that there was a group of rabbis in Tel Aviv that wrote the Internal Revenue Service.
What?
And they buried it. They wrote it in English and buried it in Illinois.
That's exactly right.
I didn't catch it.
They're trying to say that
the IRS knows that
it must be Jewish. So now, logically speaking, once we said that the laws that we have in front of us apply in Reshut HaRabim and they apply in Reshut HaNizak, but they don't apply in Reshut HaMazik, did you understand what I just said? Right? I'm talking Hebrew. They apply in Reshut HaRabim in the public domain. They apply in Reshut HaNizak in the domain of the person who was damaged, mm-hmm. like my dog went into his property, but they don't apply in Reshut HaMazik. That's obviously going to bring up the question of property owned in partnership.
Oi!
What if I and Charlie own property together? And he walks onto his property, which is also mine, and falls in the pit that I dug yesterday. Well, I'm allowed to dig the pit because it's mine, but he's allowed to walk there because it's his. What do we do?
I think you're in trouble.
I don't think there's any damage.
No damage. You think I can't dig a pit deep enough for you to fall into?
No. But I think if it's a joint ownership, then it seems to me that this law that you just read would apply, and there would be no damage because I'm partially the owner.
No, I think it's a small reshut HaRabim, but the Rabim are just the two of you.
Well, it's
very good.
That certainly has to be right, but the answer has to be it depends.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Right,
yeah.
There could be certain things that a partner is allowed to do on land owned by a partner. Other things he can't do.
If you have the common land to allow either of you to walk to where there's water, you know, then that's your common interest.
Yeah.
And if you let your wild animal go through and attack somebody while they're walking to get the water. I mean,
or if I'm living in Oregon and Charlie, you're taking care of the land, and you don't tell me that the pit that I knew was 6 inches deep is now 3 feet deep, and you tell me to walk down the path. I'm going to get you.
Okay, so since time is getting short, let's read on the Mishnah. The next three words say the following. Urshut hanizak v'hamazik. Please see the three words?
Yes.
Urshut hanizak v'hamazik. The domain of the damagee and the damager. Now that is the partnership. That's the land owned in partnership.
It's not two things. It's one reshut.
The reshut of hanizak v'mazik.
Yes.
Now, unfortunately, it's not clear how to read those three words. What I mean to say is the following. Are those three words a continuation of what is modified by the word chutz, with the exception of. Now, is it the following? With the exception of the reshut that is designated for the mazik, and the reshut that's owned by both of them, does the except go in those two categories, or does the except go in on the first but not the second? Should I read it as chutz mi reshutam yuchedet lemazik, with the exception of the reshut that is owned by the mazik, and then semicolon, and then it goes back to say when the laws do apply, reshut hanizak v'mazik. So when it says the land owned by both of them, is that an exception saying the laws don't apply there? Or is it going back to listing where the laws do apply? And that is a machloket. It's an argument in the Gemara.
Oh, neat.
So the question is,
what is that u?
So there's going to be a dispute what happens in land owned by both of them. And, of course, as you can imagine, not only is there a dispute in principle, but there's a dispute on many different details of different types of situations, which is probably fitting. In any case, the way the whole thing ends is saying, and this is the sum of it all, kshehizik, when damage was done under the conditions that were just laid out, chav hamazik l'shalem, is obligated the damager to pay, tashlimei nezik, payment for the damage, from the best of his land. And that we've discussed in the past. I would like to take just as much time as we have before people start running out to read one or two short stories, one-line stories from the Talmud that elucidate this Mishnah. And I say stories, they're a little bit whimsical, kind of to get us out of the details and start seeing a larger picture of here to apply this. So I'm looking at the sheet that I gave out with the questions on top, and we basically dealt with 80% of the questions in the past hour. And this story says, I listed it here as C, right? As C, Babylon Talmud Tractate Baba Kama, page 48a. And it says as follows. Haisha she'nichnasa litchon chitin etzel bal habayit. See those words?
Yes.
I'll translate them word for word. The woman who entered to grind wheat by bal habayit shelo birshut, without permission. In other words, I own a mill, and Carol Ann went into my mill without permission to grind her wheat.
Carol
Ann? Carol Ann. V'achaltan demto shel bal habayit, and ate them, the animal of bal habayit. And my goat came and ate her wheat before she managed to grind it. What's the law? Patur. Do you see it says patur?
Exactly.
Who's patur?
Bal habayit.
Bal habayit. I don't have to pay.
Of course
not. My goat ate her wheat, but I don't have to pay. Why? Because she was trespassing.
Makes sense.
That's what's that called in the Mishnah? In today's Mishnah?
Reshut
Hayachid. No.
Reshut
Hanizak. No.
No.
Double no.
Reshut
Mazik.
Mazik. It's the Reshut Mazik. It's the domain of the damager, right? I own the mill and I own the goat, and I damaged Carol Ann on my property. She came into my property without permission. Remember again, we're using the word Reshut in two senses. Reshut means permission. Reshut also means domain. She came into my reshut without reshut, right? She came into my domain without permission.
No,
the damage.
The other one, the domain is reshut, and permission is reshut.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. There's a little nuance there in the vowels.
Is not, our Mishnah is not doesn't have the correct vowel. It should be reshut patach.
Okay. Thank you. Let's finish the source.
It was changed later in Israel.
Ve'im chuzka. Hayevit. And if she was damaged, obligated. Now, who is the she? The she is my goat. If my goat got a tummy ache from eating her wheat, then she has to pay the doctor bills. Because you shouldn't have brought your wheat into my...
The trespasser has to pay. The trespasser has to pay the damage to the dog now.
Yeah. So again, just to summarize, if you entered my property without permission, then if you got damaged, either because my goat ate your wheat or you fell in my aquarium, you shouldn't have been there. It's your problem. And if when you fill in your aquarium, you fill killed my fish, well, you have to pay. So let's just read something similar to the next story, and then we'll go home and prepare for Shabbat. And this one is from the Babylon Talmud Tractate Baba Kama, page 48a, from the same place as you can see. Amar Rava, said Rava, who's in Babylonian about the year 320 of the Common Era, Nichnas lechatser balabait shelo birshut, entered into the courtyard of balabait without permission. So again, someone trespassed in my property. Vehizikit balabait, and he damaged the balabait. In other words, you walked into my property without permission, and it was night out, and you just happened to walk right into me, and I fell down and broke my nose. O balabait huzakbo.
What is huzak? He damaged him, or he was damaged?
In the case that the trespasser either damaged balabait, or balabait became damaged through him, it's a nuance. If the trespasser walked into me, then he damaged me.
Yeah.
If I walked into him, I didn't see him, then I was damaged by him.
Ah.
It's the same thing, that the trespasser hurt balabait either actively or passively, on purpose or not, hayav. The trespasser has to pay, because he shouldn't have been there. Even if I, the balabait, walked into him, but he shouldn't have been there, he has to pay. Hiziko balabait patur. If the balabait hurt him, patur. Does that mean the balabait can punch the trespasser in the nose on purpose? That's the discussion, next two lines. Amara papa, lo amran ela delo hava yadabe. Translation said, Rapapa, it is not said except when he didn't know about him. In other words, if the balabait hurt the trespasser inadvertently, he didn't know he's hurting him, that's what we said, that the balabait is patur. Hiziko balabait chayav. But if the balabait purposely hurt the trespasser, then the balabait has to pay.
So if he shot him as a trespasser...
Exactly, that's the law in Texas, the whole thing of the homestead. Let's just read the last line. My tam, what's the reason for this? It's abbreviated mem tet. My tam, what's the reason? Mishum damale, because he can say to him, right? Because the trespasser can say, Nehi de'it lecha reshut de'lafuke, it's true you have reshut to throw me out, lazuke, to damage me, let lecha reshuta, you don't have permission. And of course, that gets to the whole question that Texas law discusses. What do you do with a trespasser, especially if you're afraid he might be coming to damage you? And the Gemara, of course, and the literature discusses this further. If he's really coming to hurt me, to kill me. What if he's only coming to steal my wheat or my goat?
Or...